And we're back with another episode of the Sharks MTG podcast. I'm your host, Kieran Chetty. Joining me, I've got Anthony Hodgson and Kalyan Pedkov. Kalyan, how are you doing, mate?
Hey, Kieran, doing well. Playing quite a lot of Magic these last 2 weeks, and I'm glad to say it's been mostly Modern, which, like you had said a couple episodes ago, is really fun and exciting and constantly changing. Lots of new and powerful cards for us to play with, and thankfully hasn't gotten too monotonous, and I'm still interested in playing new decks and trying to figure out what's best. How about you, Kieran? How are you doing?
Cool. Yeah. Also pretty good. Also predominantly Modern. In fact, I don't think I've played anything but Modern of late, apart from, I think, the Arena Open, the Standard Open, I think 2 weeks ago or 2 weekends ago now. But yeah, so it's just been Modern and yeah, enjoying it as well, predominantly. Anthony, how are you going, pal? What's happening? I know your take on things, you've been a bit different. I know you've been hard in the arena streets with a few events there. How's it going?
Been playing Standard quite reluctantly. I mean, I do like Standard usually, but I'm quite tired of the current Standard formats, and we'll probably talk about that later. And then just a lot of drafting. There was a draft challenge on Arena where you could kind of like win a lot of resources by having a good draft. And I did that quite easily. And they've added some free drafts of old sets on Arena now. So that's going to be fun. And also, right before we went live, you yourself mentioned to me that a certain Burgles player did really well in a Modern challenge recently. So I'm suddenly looking back at Modern myself as well, because that is a deck that I know and understand and love, and maybe I'll join you guys in the Modern ring soon.
Yeah, that would be great, even if it was with Boggles. I mean, we won't hold that against you. I guess on that note, I think let's, you know, you touched on a little bit of Arena stuff that's happening, and maybe a natural progression from our last time we had a chat. We spoke about the launch of the upcoming release of Historic Horizons on Arena. And subsequently, they've pushed back the release, if I'm not mistaken. Do you want to just tell us what's happening there, Anthony, and why this is, why these changes are taking place?
Yeah, Wizards came out with an announcement last night saying that there's a big back-end update for Arena, which is pending, and the Historic Horizons Jumpstart set is tied to that back-end update, I guess, I imagine, because there's new mechanics and stuff coming with those cards. And the developers didn't feel like the back-end update was ready, and they needed a couple weeks longer, which means the set also is going to take a couple weeks longer. What that's meant is that they've had to adjust various other announcements they've made, because there was this weird thing happening where the ranked season was split in half this month, but it's now not being split in half anymore. It's actually kind of doubling up. They're giving us free drafts as a kind of apology. And then in terms of the professional scene, the big deal is that there's a MPL Gauntlet play, which is coming up. And that was going to include Historic, and now it's all going to be Standard. And so the professional players are pretty unhappy, because everyone's pretty tired of Standard, to be honest. It's like the same adventure cards over and over again, the same rehearsed like matchups. And I mean, actually, the meta has been kind of developing a bit, but it's still sort of within the same key powerful cards that the meta is revolving around. And people are really just tired of it, to be honest. And so it's a weird situation now where everyone was hoping with the dropping of the new Historic set, Historic would be interesting and we could avoid Standard for a while. But now that's delayed, and so you've got like same old Historic, same old Standard. So Arena players are not super happy right now.
I see. Well, I mean, like, it seems a bit strange, because, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, Historic Horizons was announced a week ago. Like, surely they knew about this a week ago. It couldn't have miraculously happened overnight where things changed so dramatically where you had to push everything out. Why announce it in the first place then? That's the question, right? And why set these expectations and annoy your player base?
Yeah,
seems bizarre.
I'm not sure, to be honest. There does seem to be increasingly in the last year this kind of culture of Wizards feeling like they have to constantly be releasing something. Maybe that's in response to the player base, that we've become impatient and we get bored of new sets very quickly and we constantly want new material. And so they've kind of been announced, they've been dropping sets much quicker than they were in the past, if you include across all formats. So for a player who's engaged in lots of formats, there's just always new content coming out. And I think that in this case, they, you know, got ahead of themselves. And then, look, to be fair, personally, I think it's a good thing to recognize when you've made a mistake, got ahead of yourself, and take the time that you need. I don't know if you agree with that, Carl.
100%. I think you don't want to be releasing a product that's going to not deliver to your standards and to your players' expectations. But my question to you is, do you know if the standard schedule has changed in terms of set release? Are they releasing the sets more frequently now for standard or just overall
products? No, the standard set release hasn't changed, although there's some people suggesting that it should. And we talked about a few episodes ago how it did once upon a time a few years ago.
I don't mean rotation. I mean like actual new sets releasing more frequently.
Oh, no. They also, I don't think they've actually changed that. So when I talk about new material, it's more just that there's extra anthologies and extra jump starts and
Horizon
sets.
Yeah, there's just far too many products altogether. Not to mention the paper printings and then the arena stuff as well. It's just totally overwhelming.
Yeah, but I mean, again, I can sort of see both sides of it, because as a player who plays a lot of Magic, and I don't even play every format, I mostly just play the arena formats, I have sort of felt like there's this common experience with arena that after a new set drops, everyone's having lots of fun with Magic for about 6 weeks. And then there's another 6 weeks till the next set that everyone starts to feel a bit bored and, you know, they're craving something new. And so I do think Wizards have been trying to find creative ways to release new things, whether it's like a different kind of queuing or an old draft set or extra content jumpstart or whatever. They're trying to just, you know, problem solve for always having novelty, I guess.
So to that point, how do you feel about jumpstart giving Wizards the ability to kind of keep things fresh? So now with the online-only cards, I guess they have carte blanche to patch them as things become stale or as things emerge as being too powerful or maybe not quite meeting the mark in terms of their initial expectations. What do you think about that, Anthony?
Yeah, I mean, I feel more and more that Historic is being treated a bit like a guinea pig, like an experimental set. They're trying to copy a lot of ideas that other games like Hearthstone have used, see how they perform in this sort of a Magic environment. And I was saying last week to Kron, I actually think that that's a good thing, because keep your like crazy experimentation away from my standard, do it in Historic. Maybe if they already had this commitment to experiment so much in Historic before, they wouldn't have made the mistakes with all of the cards that got banned in Standard over the recent years, because they would have been testing those ideas somewhere else. So hopefully we'll see that Standard indirectly improves a lot over the next few years with the experimentation happening outside of it.
Yeah, I like that idea where you kind of keep that space for kind of more experimental ideas and learning from what the other games have done well. I don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, copying Hearthstone, as it were. You just take the good ideas, the good concept, and you apply it to Magic. You know, Hearthstone did plenty of that with Magic, you know, to develop their game. But yeah, if you create a format that's distinct from both Standard and, you know, potentially Pioneer, so now you have Historic being a more, you know, digital only experimental kind of Wild West format. It's its own thing. It's interesting. It has novelty, like you said. And then you also create an environment where, okay, now we can fix the Standard schedule to how it was previously, not have it stagnate and kind of have everybody lose interest. And then their cards still have value in Pioneer. And now, you know, Pioneer's kind of slowed down. The cards are fairly cheap. As long as Wizards give players an incentive, they can always resurrect formats. You know, Pioneer had its flaws. I think a lot of people were turned off by the idea of inverted truth. You know, whether you believe it was oppressive and shouldn't have been around as long as it was, or you think it was totally reasonable, they just need to stay active, monitor their formats, and give play, players a good incentive to play. So just like during the quarantines last year where they introduced the super qualifiers, everybody suddenly gained interest in the format. The staples are currently pretty low in price. And yeah, I feel like it would answer all the questions. Just very neatly bring everything together. You have Historic as your online-only format that's doing interesting and new things. It's experimental. You have people coming back into Standard with a normal rotation. And then your cards are not losing value and you have a Eternal format that you can play that's essentially replacing Modern, and Modern will be taking the space of Legacy. So it just all very neatly comes together, kind of addresses your reserved list issue with people being priced out of Modern, sorry, out of Legacy. And that's my opinion on it. What do you think, Aaron?
Yeah, look, man, I'm pro Pioneer. I think it's fun. I unfortunately don't play much of it. I don't know why. I think it's just because of Modern Horizons. And when I've just started playing Magic again, it's coincided with the launch of Modern Horizons. And I've been enjoying Modern. So the little bit that I have played in Pioneer has been exciting and has been interactive. The games of Magic, you know, there's a variety of wacky, I guess, combo decks from things like Bard Class to Lotus Field. And then you've got your blue-black control decks. You've got your aggro decks. You've got your mid-range piles and Niv-Mizzet. It's quite a cool dynamic format with a lot going on, and as you say, quite cost-effective. So, yeah, I think we forget sometimes that Modern can be the barrier to entry is quite high given the cost of a lot of these Modern decks. And I mean, we've touched on this on several occasions in the past. And I'm just looking at things like Jeskai Stoneblade. Okay, not top of the pops yet at the moment, but that's $2,000 for a Modern deck. Looking at Izzet Tempo, $1,400. To give you an idea, you know, that's a hell of a lot of money for someone who wants to start into the format. And so if you could use these recent cards of yours and play these decks in Modern, like your Burn deck or whatever the case, in Pioneer, at a fraction of the cost and be competitive, that would be great, I think. I'm pro Pioneer, and I think it really should be, it deserves to be supported. And hopefully when tournament play opens up, we'll start seeing that, it'll hopefully start being supported. The reality is you need the likes of, since there's no competitive play at the moment or organized play per se, you need the likes of the SCG tours to host the tournaments, and they're the ones who'll drive it. I mean, if you remember a few years ago when they stopped supporting Legacy basically died. And they stopped supporting Legacy because of barrier to entry was too high and their Legacy opens were far smaller than any other format as a result. So I think accessibility is a big driving force that could be a pro Pioneer.
So just on the topic on Modern versus Legacy and how, you know, I had mentioned earlier that I think Modern can effectively take the place of being the old Eternal format, and Pioneer naturally would push Modern into that slot, effectively replacing it. Anthony, what do you think about the Modern Horizons printings and how analogous they are to how Legacy cards feel, right? So you have DRC, which is essentially like a super-powered Delver, and then you have the other powerful one-drop Ragavan and Murktide Regent as well that have, you know, taken over the blue tempo decks in Legacy, actually. So you're having these really cost-efficient threats and some answers. You know, we have Counterspell printed now into Modern. It's feeling more and more like Legacy in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's intentional. I think it's, you know, they're not idiots. They can see what kinds of things people like, and they're trying to make new accessible versions of the same kinds of things that people like. And I think that's just intelligent R&D by Wizards, to be honest. So I'm happy with it, and that's the kind of thing certainly that would make it more likely for me to get interested in playing more Modern, knowing that there's cool things to do which are becoming more accessible. And so even more so, what interests me about Pioneer, you know, funnily enough, in terms of comparing some of the styles, I'm a perfect example of this, because the deck I always played in Modern was Burgles. When Pioneer was first created, the deck I was playing was Black White Auras. And it's like, it functionally, it's quite similar. You don't have Hexproof, but like you're trying to just dump a bunch of auras and make something very big and protected in various ways. So I think that is quite a common thing for Magic players. People find a sort of groove that they fit into, and then they try and customize that groove and do cool things in that groove. And so I think from a design perspective, it completely makes sense to look at what's worked in older formats and then try and make accessible versions of it in other formats.
I just don't know if it's a matter of them having like this grand plan that's going to come together, you know, harmoniously and naturally as much as it is, they just do a bunch of different things and eventually some things seem like they make sense. I'm hoping it's the former and not the latter, because with Wizards personally, I've never really known what to expect.
I mean,
a lot of hits and misses.
I personally think, especially with the older formats, it's really, really hard to have a grand overview. There's so much that's interacting. There's so many different things to have to try and predict. So again, this is why I'm saying, like, when it comes to limited, it's really contained. When it comes to standard, it's really contained. You can have that sort of overall plan. But with the older formats, which are just bigger and more open, there's always an element of unforeseeability. And for those formats, for whether it's historic, whether it's pioneer, whether it's modern, whether it's legacy, I do have a sense that there's only so much that Wizards can anticipate. So maybe I'm just being cynical, but I don't think there is a major overview plan for that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, I guess time will tell. You know, there's only so much conjecture we can't really tell the future. But I will say, if you look this past weekend, the showcase, there was the showcase challenge on MTGO, the Legacy Showcase, and the winning blue-red Delver deck shared 25 of its 42 spells were found in the modern version. So the creature base of DRC, Murktide Regent, Dragon Rage Channeler, all of them are in that deck. Expressive Iteration, Mishra's Bauble, Lightning Bolt. So the overlap is incredible, you know. So the similarities between the two decks really aren't that far apart at all. So it's just really interesting to see how, I guess, power creep and how it's affected just about every format. So really interesting to see the two decks sort of blurring together, if you will, the formats rather. And essentially the same deck is ruling the roost in both formats. So quite an interesting development. But yeah, we'll see how it goes. And I suppose it's inevitable because, you know, in yesteryear you had the spells being dominant, and now with all the creatures being dominant, it's inevitable that with every new printing, it's more and more likely that those cards sort of supplant the older stuff, whether it's Snapcaster Mage or whatever, you know, Delver, etc., of years gone by.
Yeah, quick shout out to Nathan Stewart. We spoke about this before the cast, but I believe he won that event. And the big innovation for his team's version of that list was not playing any basics and maximizing red sources on turn one / blue sources on turn one, so that they can drop that threat and not have to cantrip if they don't want to. So, yeah, he posted a bunch of screenshots on his Twitter with how they played a Steam Vents as effectively their fifth volcanic island. And he posted a bunch of screenshots where he had opening hands with it and they all looked fantastic. And it was critical that was not a basic land, as he had a bunch of one mana blue spells and one mana red spells. So good job to them and to Nathan. Yeah, great result. But I hear somebody on our cast also had a good result this weekend. Karan, can you tell us about your modern challenge experience from Saturday?
Yeah, I've been experimenting with so many different decks since MH2. And one of the decks that I tried was a food deck, a Junt style food deck. And, you know, I did a couple of leagues with it, not many, and it was doing okay, you know, mostly just a couple of 4-1s, I think a 3-2, and it felt decent to me. And I thought, well, let me just try it on Saturday's challenge. And It didn't start very well because I started round one of the challenge and I was paired against Indomitable Creativity, which is a horrible matchup for the food decks because you just can't interact with them. And so my opponent both games got an Emrakul in play, I think on turn four, and you know, beat me pretty easily. So I, you know, at that point I almost dropped because, you know, to start 0-1 in a 7-round event, especially one that starts so at our time, it started at South African time at I think 5 p.m. Or was it an 8-round event? Sorry. And it started at 5 p.m. So I thought, ugh, this is probably not worth my time. But fortunately I had nothing else to do, so I stuck around and I ended up winning the rest of my Swiss rounds.
Yeah, I mean, that Indomitable Creativity deck, one of the few current players in Modern that's, you know, effectively playing a big mana role. Maybe it's more of like a in-between deck that has control and mid-range elements, similarly as the Rhino deck does, but then has like a Haymaker, in this case, Emrakul or Velomachus taking turns. But yeah, tell us a little bit about your iterating and how you got to Jund. Why a Jund food show? What cards were you looking at here that brought you to Jund?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things. You know, naturally with the package, you're priced in, if you're playing Asmo, you're priced into the shell of Asmo, Cookbook, Street Wraith, and Oval Chase. So you're priced in with those 16 cards. And the trick is to find things that sort of work around it and complement that package quite nicely. And one of the things that I wanted to do was find cards that are well positioned, just good cards that were well positioned and are okay if your opponents attack your graveyard. Because the reality is a lot of these food iterations, whether it's Esper, you know, blue, red, green, black, whatever it is, are quite strong, but often the decks end up being awful when there's a lot of graveyard hate. So the idea behind it was, can I have a deck that's powerful with the graveyard, but if my opponent really goes hard after my graveyard, still gives me some play? And so the card that came to mind was Tarmogoyf, because, you know, Tarmogoyf, often people are bringing in one-sided graveyard hate. So whether it's Endurance, Soul Guide Lantern, you know, that sort of thing. So those are the most commonly played, I would say, cards in Modern in terms of graveyard hate. And to an extent, I guess, out of the Hammer decks in particular, the Sanctifier on Vec. So Tarmogoyf, what it allowed you to do was have a massive beater that didn't care about anything else going on and often was out of the range. Importantly, the critical part is out of the range of Unholy Heat. So as a starting point, I figured Unholy Heat would, as Tarmogoyf would be a nice place to go, because on turn two, you drop your Saga, you drop your Tarmogoyf, you only need a single green, and it allows you to, you know, that can work. And I thought that would be the natural place to start. I didn't want to go with Dragon Rage Channeler because, although it seems like the natural fit and there's some synergy there, you know, you can flip over Oval Chase Daredevil, etc. And it meant you had to play a lot of, you know, bad cards like Bauble. And I mean, I know that might sound a little controversial, but in essence, you know, your deck, you can only fit so many cards into it. And when you've got a deck like Asmo that already sort of restricts you by playing 16 spells, the rest of your spells, you need to make sure that it's efficient and it does something really important to the plan, or so I thought.
So yeah, you need some hard hitters, right? Something that's actually got some oomph. Otherwise, your deck's all A. You already have four Street Wraiths, and if you're adding four Baubles, where's the meat of the deck? And I think without Luris, you don't really want Bauble. Those kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah, so it's not just. I mean, there's Oval Chase Daredevil, Street Wraith, and then you'd have Bauble. So you'd have, and Cookbook to an extent does nothing, right? Like on its own. So then you'd have 16 cards that do nothing, in a vacuum. And so that's kind of the logic behind it. And I know that a lot of people would probably disagree with that. But yeah, that's kind of where it started.
So speaking of Cookbook doing nothing in a vacuum, there is a card that it synergizes very, very well with, and that card is Urza's Saga, essentially hyper-powering your constructs that the Saga would churn out. So can you tell us a little bit about Urza's Saga? Why are you putting that card in a three-color deck, and how are you pulling it off here?
Well, in essence, you're really a two-color deck. I mean, there's a light splash for black, and the reason why I splashed for black was, and it's only four cards essentially, you know, if you're discounting things like Oval Chase, Daredevil, and Street Wraith, is really you're not casting that too often. But it's two Bone Shards and two Grist the Hunger Tide. And the reason for those, initially I started off with two Lightning Axe, and I kept on getting to game states where things would be okay, I'd be in a favorable position, then my blue-red opponent would drop a Murktide Regent, an 8-8 Murktide Regent. And often I didn't have enough food to activate Asmo twice, or they've dealt with my Asmo and now I've got Lightning Bolt, which doesn't deal with it. So I wanted more ways to deal with big threats. And in the last couple of weeks, blue-red, you know, of course, is there and thereabouts, but also we saw a rise in these, whether it's Grixis and red-black sort of decks with Scourge of the Skyclave and with Death Shadows popping up here and there. So I wanted efficient answers that synergized into the deck. So essentially, you're playing a two-color deck, and it's the splash is in essence kind of free with your mana base, because you've got a bunch of shock lands that facilitate, and fetch lands that facilitate that light splash. So it works. Is it ideal? Absolutely not. I think I did make some deck building mistakes. I think, to your point and, about ensuring consistency, I think the basic swamp was, the basic mountain was absolutely a mistake in the deck, because the other key card that we played in the deck was, Finale of Devastation, which is one of the big reasons to play this deck over, let's say, blue-red versions, Urza versions of Asmo, because the ability to tutor up Asmo on turn two and put it into play is incredibly powerful. So that's one problem that I made, probably one big mistake. And I probably should have had one Yavimaya Cradle in the deck as well to help our sagas produce green. So those are the two things that I think are big mistakes, you know, but I guess this is where you learn. You make these mistakes and you learn. And there was an element of being ambitious and trying to fit too many good cards into a deck, like Renin 6, for example, which is also a little ambitious.
Exactly what came to mind. So Renin 6, to me, is another one of those cards that you mentioned before, really well positioned right now. Lines up well against the controlling decks. If you cast a Renin 6 on turn 2, it's often lights out, particularly if you're on the play. You just get that emblem, get consistent value over time. You know, this deck, your version was playing, I believe, either 6 or 7 fetch lands. And then personally, through watching you on Saturday and taking the deck to a local event on Sunday, the thing that struck me as the most powerful and most impressive was Renin 6 in combination with Urza Saga, and how that loop is just so unrelenting. Once you get that going, and God forbid you draw a second Urza Saga, it's just a loop of infinite value. You don't even have to contribute anything from your hand. It's just self-sustaining, and without your opponent being able to break that up first, which, you know, is difficult enough in itself, you then have follow-up as you've drawn so many cards over time. So you want to tell us a little bit about the combination of Renin 6 and Urza Saga?
Yeah, so to start with, and to be clear, it is ambitious to have a card that costs red and green in a deck with four colorless lands that, of course, can't tap for mana. So just let's get that out the way. However, with having this compromise of playing this powerful card and knowing that occasionally you're going to have trouble, is the trouble worth it? And I'd venture to say that the risk is, because, as Cal alluded to, in many matchups, I felt as though whenever I got a turn two Ren and six on the play and picked off a one drop, I felt like it was impossible for me to win the match from there. Because thereafter, my opponent needed to use a removal spell on the Ren. Or if they didn't have a removal spell, the Ren just went to town, getting me a free card every turn and eventually buried the opponent. You know, the reason, the second part of Ren, which what makes it so amazing, and as Cal alluded to, was the saga, recurring sagas. And you usually only need to recur the saga once for your opponent to be buried. And I feel like there's very few decks that have a better late game than this particular iteration of the saga deck by recurring, having this built-in engine that just will guarantee to bury your opponent under a stream of constructs, if you will. Is if sometimes, you know, you might have to play the first Urza Saga defensively, you know, just to stabilize, trade off, trade resources with an opponent. But the second one probably is going to win you the game, if not the third one, definitely would. So, yeah, hugely impressive, albeit at a risk of a little bit of consistency. So if your plan is to fight the longer game, and I guess that is one of the differentiating factors, is that this, you know, some other versions that we've seen in the past, I think Spider Space top aided one of the challenges as well a few weeks back with more with the mono red, basically a red-black version. But he had the 8-1 drops, DRCs, and Ragavans. And so he was going, approach was going, let's go all out aggression. Where my version tried to go a little bit over the top, if you will, of the other decks.
So I see there's another version, a third, that Doomwake streamed yesterday, I believe. So he queued up or fired up his stream and ran three different lists. The third one is also playing a bunch of 1-drops. But is also kind of on that grindy plan. So it's a 2-color one, just a straight Golgari version with Gilded Goose and the Cauldron Familiar Trail of Crumbs package. Can you tell us a little bit about that list and how it's different to the DRC or Ren and Six versions?
Yeah, I think you're set up really well to grind. With this particular build of the deck, you will go over the top and you will bury a lot of the mid-range decks with Trail of Crumbs. You know, the reality is blue-red style decks can't interact very well with the Trail of Crumbs. However, all that being said, is it still has a glaring weakness, and both of these decks have a glaring weakness in that they just fold to a Murktide Regent. So I think that is a problem, and I don't think that's a viable strategy in this format of modern. Going in with a deck that just is absolutely cold to you know, one of the best threats and most popular threats running around in arguably the best deck. So it has all the grind tools. I like it. I like a lot of what's going on there, but it's very slow. And without things like DRC, Ragavan, or even Tarmogoyf to just punch through early, you are trying to be very slow and very reactive with this deck, with this build.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are just taking for granted that they're going to have sufficient food and Asmo available to them in the games, and that they'll be able to team up and take down a Murktide, whether that be Bolt in combination with food or 2 Asmo activations. But yeah, I mean, these blue red decks, or just decks with blue in general, have a lot of different tools available to them. You know, it's very presumptuous thinking that you know, have Asmo sticking around. It can get bolted, it can get stolen by Archmage's Charm, which has been personally one of the biggest thorns for me in this modern format, with how much I've played Hammer Time, and now this food deck. Absolutely hate Archmage's Charm. It's taking all my good stuff, my germs that have Caldras on them, my big constructs, my creatures equipped with Colossus Hammer, and now, unfortunately, my Asmos. But yeah, I think your idea of, you know, putting a couple cards together that seem to have divergent game plans actually very effective, because on the one hand, you are stressing the blue-red player to answer every single threat you present. You're putting an immense amount of pressure on them to have counter spells, to have lightning bolts, and you know, whatever ends up sticking is going to take over, whether that be your Renin 6 or your Tarmogoyf. So
yeah, and like, you know, just to emphasize that point, I lost in the top 8 against blue red, and I think the way I lost in games 2 and 3 was on both occasions my opponent had cast an 8/8 Murktide and I couldn't deal with it. I didn't have, you know, the bone shards or the grist to deal with it. So even in my deck with four main board answers, and I had, I think, a big game hunter out the sideboard, you know, I just didn't have it. So I think these other versions that are cold to it are incredibly ambitious. And I'm not sure, like, is the plan just to get lucky? Is the hope to get lucky, as you say, but it seems crazy to me. And I could be wrong in the way I built the deck. I mean, it might be right to have just play straight up Terminate or something else, you know, in the slot of Grist. But I felt like the one of Grist worked synergized quite nicely with maybe you mull over a Daredevil. You can occasionally tutor for it. It does come up. And I mean, I beat mull by burning them out with Grist after they've mulled all my, you know, creatures into my yard. So there are some fringe applications where Grist does some other work besides just, you know, killing Murktides.
Yeah, I mean, Grist looks like a very strong card, but I think for it to have maximum effectiveness, it needs to have stuck around a turn in order to provide that one insect token fodder. And I have the same criticism of Bone Shards that, you know, most of your creatures are high quality. Unless your Ragavan's been blanked, you don't really have anything that you want to sacrifice. Or unless maybe you have no cookbook action going on and you've created a construct that's only a 1/1. It's typically fairly costly, but you know, again, you're only using those cards when you really need to, and you do really need to use them when you're facing a massive Murktide. So, you know, since you're a bit of a mad scientist and the resident brewer of the cast, I want to pose you a question here, Karan. So, you know, we like iterating, we like exploring new spaces. I had mentioned that what I found most appealing from this Junfu deck was the Renin 6 in combination with Urza's Saga. What happens if we replace black and we add blue, and now we go full Urza? We finally get an opportunity to reintroduce Urza with Saga and Renin 6. Is that something that's viable? What do you think?
I don't understand what Urza gives you, because you don't have anything to do with the mana, really. Right? Like, you can use your food turns into mana, but what are you doing with that mana? So you're going to spend 4 mana to put a 1/4 into play and obviously a construct, which is nice. So is it a format that wants an extra construct? I don't think so. I don't think that Urza is the way to go. And I tried looking at some iterations with Urza, with expressive iteration, actually, because I'm really high on the card. But I felt that expressive iteration wasn't necessarily what you wanted, because I don't feel like you ever ran out of things to do with the deck. You know, it's just either you were run over typically, you know, you didn't get your engine going, or, you know, but in the long game, you typically had a lot to do with all of your food and activations and recurring sagas. So I'm not sure what Urza gives you. Urza also provides, because it's double blue, it adds another bit of complexity. How are you going to cast Finale of Devastation and Urza? And maybe you don't. Maybe you don't play Finale. But then why? Why would you not want to play an Asmo deck where, you know, you can guarantee tutor for it on turn 2? I feel like Asmo is the reason to play the deck. And if it's the reason to play the deck, then you need to play a build that can tutor it up.
Yeah, and you're probably falling into that same trap there. You're steering away from black and suddenly you're dying to Murktide Regent once again. So yeah, more stress on the mana base. I guess Urza wouldn't really be doing much for you. Maybe you could make it more of a mid-range slanting control deck and put a higher emphasis on blue and maybe steer away from green and just minimize that for Goyf. But yeah, then again, you wouldn't be playing Finale. So many new issues that it poses. And just like any sort of brewing in Modern right now, it's all a balancing act and trying to figure out what cards you put the most value on and be able to justify their inclusion in the decks, right? So all the brews, essentially, that are going on right now are just different combinations of really good cards. But I see Anthony has something to say here, so why don't you go ahead, Anthony?
I just wanted to ask, Karan, with respect to the Golgari version that Carl was talking about, that build to me, as someone who doesn't know Modern that well, it seems like the aim in that build is to be super streamlined and consistent and just like always be doing the same thing as much as you can. And it sounds like your approach with the Jant build is quite opposite of that. It's like you're trying to have different powerful things that you can do to attack your opponent. And so I just wanted to ask if you think that that's something about the Modern format that you're preferring right now, is having multiple angles of attack as opposed to just one streamlined, consistent strategy. And if you could talk about why, maybe.
In essence, I guess you're right. This green-black list that I think the tops, this person top 16, somewhere in the top 16 of the same challenge, is very much all in, with the exception of Nettlesist, which I guess is there to take advantage of those draws where you've got tons of food, but you know need a heavy hitter to sort of finish the game off. I guess this person figured that they wanted to outgrind all the mid-range decks, and this was a good way to do it. To your point, I think, yes, there is this diversity and there are different ways. So this is clearly going all in and saying, I don't care about the graveyard hate. This is my plan. I guess my way to go around, get around the graveyard hate is Nettlesist. So that's how I'm going to circumvent it. And perhaps if we played a bit with this deck, maybe we'd find that that's sufficient to do that. But although I'm not necessarily convinced by that. And, you know, where my approach was very much cognizant of how do I win? Essentially, what I was trying to do was say, okay, what would the typical Jund-style good stuff deck look like in the year 2021? Well, it's not going to play. It's basically what we ended up playing, right? It's Asmo package plus Tarmogoyf plus Ren plus Ragavan. You know, and essentially two very different decks and different approaches. And yeah, I do love the fact that whatever you're feeling on a given day or a tournament or moment, you can sort of tailor your experience and try and, you know, steer in that direction to take advantage of a metagame.
Yeah, I think going back to the reasons to play the Jund deck versus over any other type of food deck and how it's kind of presenting two different game plans in a sense is everything you cast is top quality. Everything you cast is a must answer threat. You're coming out of the gates immediately with Ragavan. If you don't answer Ragavan, the game is going to snowball in your favor. You can do whatever you want. You're going to win that game, with the exception of somebody going over the top of you. But with things being a mid-range arm race as they currently are, it's unlikely to be the case. And again, playing Tarmogoyf is just another one of those threats that gets out of the range of Unholy Heat. And it's a very low investment, right? Again, it's a 2 casting cost threat as opposed to Nettlesist being a 3. And you're not putting all your eggs in one basket. So with Nettlesist now, you're kind of risking putting all of your eggs in the artifact basket, right? So somebody that has come prepared against the artifacts, maybe a hammer deck, can really lean into having the Ancient Grudges maximize damage against you. Like, I don't typically care about having someone sign an Ancient Grudge against me. I can afford to have 2 constructs killed, or a cookbook and a construct, or a shadow spear and a construct, but I want my Goyf to demand answers, and then that's going to leave a hole for me to get my Asmo engine online and then dominate the game.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head, and maybe I didn't articulate it as clearly, but essentially, it was twofold. One, I was trying to look for a plan that perhaps made us less susceptible to the hate, which I think we sort of achieved. But two, to just play a bunch of the best cards and some of the well-positioned cards in Modern, like Ren and Goyf. And we sort of, I think we sort of did that. But I will say that now, just thinking about it, Nettlesys being able to equip, you know, the goose or the cats, you know, these rubbish creatures, I can see it being an absolute horror show for the mid-range decks. So I guess I can see why the deck was really, why the person did really well. And, you know, it's pretty cool. If you're going in and you're trying to outgrind these mid-range black, red decks, etc., it's a very good, looks like a very good place to go, provided you can avoid the hate. But I think to your point about hate and not caring about the hate, I think I shared with you guys, I think it might have been round, I can't remember, it was like round five maybe of the challenge. And it was the deciding game. And I decided to, I was on the draw and I did something which probably crazy, but I sideboarded all four sagas out of the deck, which, you know, probably not intuitive. I don't think there's too many people that would have done it. And I can't even articulate exactly why I did it, but it felt like the right thing to do. It felt like my opponent was playing in such a way. And I saw Blood Moons, I think, or is it Alpine Moons? I get a bit hazy. And I felt like one of the ways you lose the post-board games is when you have a double saga draw and your opponent goes, you know, moon. So he's got, your opponent's got that angle of attack on top of 8/8 Murktide regions, which are very difficult for the deck to deal with. So I thought, let's take this out completely, because ordinarily what I was doing was trimming down the package. So, you know, shaving the street raids and oval chases and bringing in other good cards. Instead, what I did was I sort of steered into the mid-range plan and went, let's play my good cards. Let's bring in Endurance to deal with his graveyard and to hopefully ambush his creatures. Let's bring in Fury to, you know, wipe out creatures if he goes wide early. So I brought in all those sort of elements, big game hunter. And then I kept the combo in fully and pulled out the saga. So I was a 17 land deck, which I know probably a little bit crazy. I was on the draw with four street raids, and the deciding game was brilliant. I kept a no lander with you know, the combo with double street rate, I think Asmo, and I drew the land, I went off, and, you know, I dismantled my opponent, and it worked beautifully. And it's something that I didn't do again in the tournament, but it came up, and I thought it was just an interesting anecdote on how to sort of sidestep hate and really change the plan from being this deck that's worried about Urza Saga and maximizing Saga to, well, I'm just going to play great rares and mythics, curve out, and I'm going to smash you with them, you know, and I thought that was cool.
Probably the decision to take out the sagas, you know, since you can't articulate it, well, can be chalked down to 10,000 hours intuition, right? You play enough Magic, sometimes you don't have the reasons or the explanation, but you feel that it's the right thing to do. I think we've heard of many stories similar to that, so whether it was correct or not, there's a reason deep down in the recesses of your Magic experience that helped you make that decision.
Yeah, 20 years of Magic makes you do crazy things, I guess.
So, Karan, I mean, you've spoken to it quite at length, but I just want to ask you directly, do you conceive of your deck as being like an Asmo deck, or do you conceive of it as being a good stuff deck and one of the good things it can do involves Asmo?
So I think somewhere in the middle. I think the answer is it's somewhere in the middle, because, you know, you don't have to have Asmo in your opening hand. It's not, you know, you're not devastated if you don't have it, although it is nice to have. So I think it's a little bit of both. It's definitely an Asmo deck in the sense that, well, you're playing all these cards that take up the space. So, you know, you do need to get it in play at some point. Otherwise, what are you doing? But yeah, it's a little bit in between, I guess, which I think is a good thing.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, you know, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. Game three of that quarterfinals match, you're in a position where you had a very powerful hand with the exception of it being a one lander. This was on the draw in the deciding game. And, you know, the opponent did the same thing the previous game. They hit their land drops after missing their second land drop, and you unfortunately didn't, which brought your run to an end. Nevertheless, very impressive. You know, people underestimate the developing nations, but there are lots of good players all over the world, whether that be in the Far East or in South America. And clearly we show that South Africa is bringing fire to the game as well. So let's move on here to the winning list of that challenge. It was a Hammer Time list. It is slightly different to the typical deck in that they've upped the land count to 23 lands and completely trimmed on the essentially toolbox aspect of the deck, where sagas would typically be providing either Pithy Needles, some sort of spell bomb, or Graveyard Hate. There's no removal main, and they're maximizing having access to their Ink Moths. They're not trimming any of those, and they're playing 11 planes. And I think the reason for that is because they've chosen to go with a Giver of Runes package. So they want to maximize their turn one white sources. They've even trimmed a Springleaf Drum to hedge against flooding, you know, after having introduced the two extra lands. And I think the sideboard mostly is doing a lot of the same things. They have max sanctifiers, which I think Karan and I can agree on. And he suggested very early on, it's one of the best cards in the deck that lines up best against the other top decks in the format. What do you think of this build, guys, and why is Hammer still having success?
Well, I mean, it's if I'm not mistaken, it's fairly similar to the winning list from the, I want to say the Mana, is it Mana Traders? Their series that was up recently, won by X-Whale. It's fairly similar in the creature base and the approach. I think the difference, as you say, is the land count being upped a little bit and one or two utility things. So I think it's that list that very similar, or it's been inspired by that list. I mean, it's just a good deck. It's just got redundancy. It's very difficult to grind them out because of, you know, the plan B of Sagas plus Lurrus. It's just a very, very good deck that can play at instant speed. I mean, they're playing things like a lot of artifacts and enchantments to enable them, which makes it difficult. You know, you've got good tutors in the form of, you know, Stoneforge Mystic, Steel Shaper's Gift, etc. So it's just a very good, resilient deck that's super cheap and efficient. So it's difficult to get around them. And the reality is playing against it with almost any deck, like, going one for one removal just doesn't work. It's not a winning proposition unless it's backed up with a lot of pressure. And I think that's the key to beating this deck, is that you need to put on a clock first and foremost before trying to beat them. It's no point trying to be reactive unless, you know, I guess your deck's full of, I don't know, engineered explosives and all kinds of weird stuff, but still then it might be difficult. So you've got to put the pressure on them. And I think a lot of decks don't do a good job of that.
Yeah, so I've actually played quite a lot of Hammer Time. I'm not a modern expert by any means, but in terms of the games that I've played, I have played the most games with this deck right now. And in my experience, I have found that when I've lost, it's been because, you know, essentially my core plan has been taken apart and I haven't been able to either find the pieces or, you know, had one aspect of the plan disrupted, whether it's had the hammer stolen, countered or killed, or just had all my creatures picked off. So I think in the same way that you're trying to overload other people's answers from the Asmo Jan Food side of things, Giver of Ruins is kind of facilitating that plan as well. So it's, if you don't answer it, it will protect the things that need to be answered. And so that's probably how they're able to force through and take over. So we actually tried to iterate a little bit on the Hammer Time deck as well. Karan initially tried to introduce blue for Urza, and maybe it is a trap because it didn't really add anything. And then what else did we try to do to this deck, Karan?
We went a little crazy and added four Thought Monitors to it. Along with four artifact lands, the blue-white artifact, the tap lands, which, you know, might seem a bit criminal given the nature of the deck, as well as the good thing was adding good cards like Kaldra Complete for Stoneforge Mystic to tutor up. And maybe you should tell us about your experience, because you're the one who actually piloted the deck. I think you took it to a local tournament recently, Cal.
Yeah, I mean, the artifact lands, they do come in tapped, which is definitely an issue when you're trying to maximize your mana on each of the turns. So I think in many ways, this deck does resemble a legacy deck or something like a Death Shadow deck for the modern players out there that haven't had a chance to play legacy. I think with the exception, so I, you know, again, it's a four-round tournament. It's not like I've played three or four leagues and really have an understanding of the deck, but from the, you know, 11 or so games that I played, I think it only came up twice where I was really hurting for the mana from those tap lands. But yeah, Thought Monitor, when you're slightly behind or at parity, was very good. It just gives you that little bump that you need to gas up, and then it's another flying threat that you can instant speed attach a hammer to, and that can take down planeswalkers and just giving you another avenue essentially. So I did like it quite a lot. And you know, having those lands and access to blue does give the deck an extra piece of resilience in the form of counter spells coming out of the sideboard, which I did really like. I think we had played a league with the Urza build where that also had counter spells, and those came in clutch when we were able to draw them. Unfortunately, I didn't draw any of mine, so I wasn't able to speak on that through this small tournament. But at the end of the day, you know, as you do when you play artifact lands, I ended up losing in the finals, games 2 and 3, after taking the first game to a blue-white gentleman who got me with Stony Silence twice. So yeah, live by the sword, die by the sword once again. And I see you have something to say.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, are there any popular decks in Modern right now that are mainboarding Chalice? It seems like Chalice on one would be really hard for you to beat on Hammer Time.
Yeah, there's quite a few decks. I mean, Eldrazi Tron, which is resurfaced. I think they split the finals of one of the challenges last weekend, plays 4 Chalice. People have tried it, you know, to varying degrees of success in things like the breach decks. The Valakut decks. So they've tried it in those. You see it pop up occasionally in control shells playing 4 prismatic endings, etc. So it is possible. The problem is it's not as good as you think it is, because often, like I've shown Cal as well, that a number of these weird decks that I've been playing as well, like my opponent goes turn 2 Chalice of the Void and my deck with 21 drops, and they still lose because Murktide Regent just laughs at them and goes over the top and, you know, smashes in. Or you're playing a deck that has mainboard answers, whether it's things like Prismari Command in the Rhinos deck or the Creativity deck, or you're playing Culligan's Command in all the red-black decks. So not as good as you think it would be, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, but and in terms of... Sorry, Anthony, to interrupt you. Just to answer your question from the Hammer Time point of view, so you would think that you would be cold, and it is highly effective on one against this deck. However, you do have other avenues. So you want to be, in those cases, you want to be drawing Urza Saga, which, you know, is providing large constructs, which are threatening. And then it's also able to put the equipment directly onto the battlefield, thereby circumventing Chalice. And in the same way, Stormforge Mystic can also put equipment directly onto the battlefield. So while you're not going to be able to equip via Sigarda's Aid, if you draw a Pure Steel, you're still able to get around that.
Okay, so actually slightly more resistant to the Chalice than like Burgles is. Because my experience, if I'm on the draw, my opponent plays the Chalice for 1, you know, I'm in big trouble. And back then, you could at least play your Spirit Dancer and you still get your draws, even though the spells get countered. But the current Burgles lists aren't even playing the Spirit Dancers, it seems. So, like, they're just going to scoop pretty much the Chalice. So interesting, yeah, that you've identified. There's some lines. I mean, look, as much as you are identifying there's some lines, if your opponent goes Chalice on 1, you're probably unfavored at that point, right?
100%, yeah. I'm not going to downplay that. So, guys, you know, we're seeing this mid-range arms race. People are faffing around trying to control the board and grind each other out. And what is very effective against that? Big mana. And what do we see? Natural cycle of modern, next day, boom, 3 Tron decks in the top 8. Karan, can you tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah, it makes sense. Completely makes sense. I mean, Tron would typically laugh at these mid-range decks, whether it's Elementals, which won one of the challenges last week, and I think put 3 people in the top 8 of last week's Sunday challenge. So, you know, I think Tron will laugh off of these decks and just eat them up, because these decks just can't disrupt them. Game 1, anyway. So you're starting off 0-1, you know, 1 game down, and you're hoping in your games 2 and 3 that your hate, firstly, you have sufficient hate in your sideboard, and secondly, that you actually draw them. And then I guess thirdly, that Tron doesn't have the answer anyway, Nature's Claim or whatever the case is, to stop your Blood Moons or Alpine Moons. So yeah, it just the natural cycle. Tron came in and just absolutely murders all these, you know, whether it's Elementals or I guess the food decks, and just cleaned up house. So very smart by the people, I guess, who chose to play those decks. And yeah, I wasn't surprised at all that it made it turn to the top. And it's something, I mean, we spoke about and said that it was inevitable. It was going to happen, I think, on one of our last shows, because of the nature of things, and these cycles happen, and you know, don't be surprised when I guess Burn or Blitz makes a comeback, because it's just going to go under Tron and just, you know, tear them apart.
Yeah, so one thing that I like about the second place Tron list is that it does have relics in it, and you know, we spoke about this previously on the cast. A lot of the top decks right now are also quite soft to relic. Another reason why we're looking to kind of bypass strategies or threats that are too reliant on the graveyard. I think personally, you know, again, I'm not a Tron specialist, but if I had to critique this list, I'd probably want to up the number of relics in this list. The person has 2 relics main, and I believe a crypt and a Gravedigger's Cage side for their Khan Liberated. Sorry, for their Khan the Great Creator that they're running main. So, you know, potentially sufficient coverage. Maybe I'm not correct in my criticism, but it does look like they were ultimately taken out by a Living End deck in the finals, which I don't know. What do you guys think about that matchup? Living End versus Tron?
I actually have no idea. I have no idea how that would play out. Like, I mean, if you think about it, the Living End player in these days has Force of Negation, which is pretty clutch. So they can stop Ugin or All Is Dust or any of the sweepers, you know. So you can, alternatively, you don't even have to do that, depending on how your... Are the Living End decks still playing Violent Outburst?
Yeah, this list has it.
Yeah, so, I mean, you can just wait, fill up your graveyard, especially in game 1, where most of the Tron decks aren't playing Graveyard Hate. End of turn, Violent Outburst, and kill the Tron opponent, and maybe just counter their key, whatever it is, spell that they play. So I guess it should be, from that sense, it should be quite favorable, you would think. And they've got Grief, you know, these Grieving End lists as well. So they've got Grief, and they've got Force of Negation, 4 Grief main board to disrupt the Tron deck. So kind of makes sense without having played that matchup.
Quite versatile, more disruption coming out of the sideboard. They have Foundation Breakers, they have Subtleties, they have Force of Vigors, and even Brazen Borrower. So yeah, Tron can be a bit clunky. They're, you know, kind of one-dimensional. They are slamming you with Haymakers, but typically that is 1 per turn. And if you're able to systematically answer those by having coverage that your, you know, essentially expendable creatures provide, and then just bring them all back, I can see how Living End deck can take that match. Another interesting little tweak on an existing deck from that same challenge is a, you know, potentially not the most, not the like the craziest ever experimentation, but there is another Hammer Time deck, Splashing for Red. It's a very slight splash. Main deck, there's only 1 card, and that's Magnetic Theft. So they're not playing the Steel Shaper's Gift as an additional way to find the hammer, but essentially an additional way to attach an equipment. to a creature at instant speed in this case. And I guess if you're expecting a lot of mirrors, this could be a cute little piece of tech where you can potentially mid-combat or out of nowhere take your opponent's hammer or whatever their equipment is and attach it to one of your creatures. And then they have wear tear in the sideboard, which is just a very good card. A good way to get around Chalice as well.
Yeah, or you can imagine the hammer just lying in play and, you know, your opponent attacks with a couple of, you know, Memnites or Ornithopters or whatever the case is. The one that's unblocked, oops, surprise, yeah, take 10, you're dead, you know. So it makes it very difficult, I guess, to play around that. So quite a cool little trick, I suppose. I think we guys, I think we've touched quite a bit on Modern for today, and I think the format's still incredibly dynamic. And I guess that's the next iteration. The next time we're here, hopefully we'll have some new tales to tell and try and find ways to sort of attack the metagame. And yeah, maybe it's to be a little more aggressive now and find interesting ways of doing that in powerful shells. And take it from there. But I guess it's been good. It's been a good chat. It's been nice hanging out with you boys. Anything else before we sign off?
That's it for me.
Well, I just want to say for anyone who's listening, if you do play on MTG Arena, there will be a couple of free drafts available to you in the next few weeks. There's one right now for, I think, Amon Khet Remastered. And then after 5 days, it's a different set. And then after another 5 days, another set. So three separate draft formats, which will have one free draft available for everyone. So go take advantage of that.
And on that generous note, we're out.